Welcome to Crime Conversations, the true crime podcast brought to you by CrimeCon UK, the ultimate true crime weekend. In the lead up to CrimeCon in London on September 25th and 26th, each week we're bringing two of our favourite podcasts together to find out more about their fascination with true crime. Each conversation will explore subjects including how they got involved in true crime, the cases that have stuck in their mind, the process behind their podcast, and what they think makes a great true crime show. We'd also like to say a big thank you to all those true crime fans who sent questions to ask our guests. To find out who we'll be featuring on the podcast across the season, and for more information on our London event, check crimecon.co.uk or visit our Instagram page at crimecon_UK. Let's find out who's on this episode.
Hi, I'm Joshua Miles. I am the host of the Crime Time podcast, This Week in True Crime, and a YouTube channel by the same name, Joshua Miles. And I cover true crime cases in depth in a documentary style across all platforms. And in This Week in True Crime, I also do current and ongoing events in true crime.
Hi, I'm Dr. Shaham Das, host of A Psych for Sore Minds, a YouTube channel which addresses a whole range of mental health issues, some of which are related to offending.
So Joshua, I've been looking at your videos on your channel, really entertaining, very detailed. How long have you been doing this for?
I've been uploading on the channel for true crime, I think since October of 2016, maybe 2017. Because I was working in America in the music industry and I was far away from friends, family. I was there for 6 months and I just really needed a hobby that wasn't my job at the time. And I was watching a lot of Ellen O'Neill. I don't know if you've heard of her, and Georgia Marie, some of my really good friends now, but I was watching their YouTube channels back then. And I was like, you know, this would be really good practice for videography because I did music videos. And then also I've always had this morbid curiosity into true crime all the time. Since before I can remember, my mum and I used to sit and watch Murder, She Wrote on TV. And the Madeleine McCann case is probably the biggest thing that kind of made it all very real when I was a lot younger, because that was what, 2006-7, and I was in year 4-5 at school. I was young, and they had a memorial at school, and my mum always told me that I used to not be able to walk past it because it's just so impactful. And I think from then onwards I just had this curiosity. I think everyone has a bit of a morbid curiosity into true crime. I think that's why it's so popular online and in on Netflix and on TV. You know, it's a fear of the unknown, but we've got that curiosity into it.
I completely agree. I think that there is this new kind of wave of interest about true crime, and it seems relatively recent. Like I think all these Netflix documentaries, etc., they've only really started or got momentum in the last sort of 4 or 5 years. What do you think is the reason that it's been in the last 4 or 5 years and not, say, the 10 years before then?
I think the accessibility of it has really expanded. I think the internet's played a massive part. I mean, I don't know if you saw the Elisa Lam Netflix documentary, which I'm not going to get started on because I do not like that documentary on Netflix, but that talks about web sleuths, and I had a few of my creator friends, they were interviewed for it. It just demonstrated how all these people, they came online and they were in this web forum. I don't know if you've heard of web sleuths. It's like this internet forum where people just browse through things and like try and be a detective. I don't really know. I don't go on it. With the Elisa Lam case, they had all these different theories, and they actually made a massive mistake and accused somebody who was definitely not involved of being involved and practically ruined their lives. But it just goes to show that it was just this big herd mentality of trying to solve this case and find an answer, and everyone just really wanted to be a bit of a hero. And I think that plays into how the mainstream media also portrays cases, because they always portray it as in, can you try and guess who done it before the episode's out? And I think that value of entertainment brought into the fact that it is so morbidly curious, it's kind of the perfect combination, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I wonder whether the interest's always been there, but maybe the big kind of corporations and channels and TV outlets never really picked up on it before. And it's only because people like yourself have been making their own material that now, in the last few years, people have taken notice.
It was a really old case, maybe early 1900s. And one of the things that stuck out is it was this really horrible murder, and people flocked to the crime scene to take away a cake that one of the victims had made before they had died, and they were trying to chip away paint, which had bloodstains on, to take home to say that they'd been at the crime scene. So I do think that there's always been rooted this need to go and see and learn about those kinds of things and fascination about it. And I think really with the advances in media and the accessibility of media, it's just kind of skyrocketed completely.
So what about yourself? Where did your personal fascination come from, do you think?
Definitely the Madeleine McCann case. It's a case that I will never cover because it is just too much. But I think that one was the first major instance where I realized, because, you know, I grew up in a Christian household, right? I was going to a Christian school. I was very bubbled, like bubble wraps, protected. My dad's South African, so he's seen a lot of stuff. And I think he just wanted to protect me and my brothers. And we just grew up in a very happy kind of bubble away from the world. So we never really saw any of the truth of what is going on in the world and any of the dangers. And I think the Madeleine McCann case, it's impossible to avoid it when it was on the news and it was everywhere. And I think that was my first exposure to negativity in the world to that degree. And I think from then I was just kind of hooked curiously into that. What got you into doing forensic psychiatry, if that, I can't remember if that's correct. I think that's correct.
That is correct. So I suppose I was a bit like yourself. I was morbidly fascinated with crime. I was fascinated with the image of crime, to be perfectly honest. So as a young teenager, I loved gangster rap. I listened to stuff like Cypress Hill, Wu-Tang, Snoop Doggy Dogg. And I knew it was fantasy. I didn't, you know, actually think that this was my reality. Maybe a bit like you, I grew up in quite a sheltered, boring little village in Cheshire. And I think that was the first time that I felt a connection to it. And it's only much, much later that I got interested in true crime. But to answer your question, I went to medical school and I had no idea what I wanted to do. I just didn't really plan for the future. And then I just kind of stumbled into psychiatry because I did a placement on a psychiatric ward in Edinburgh. Just fell in love with it straight away. I think the people that I worked with were really friendly. So a lot of other subspecialties, especially like surgery, they basically treat medical students like something that they've scraped off the bottom of their shoe. They just see you as an...
Is it like in Grey's Anatomy? I must have a medical degree. I've watched all of Grey's Anatomy. Come on.
I've not actually seen Grey's Anatomy, but is that what they do?
It's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. One surgeon can do absolutely everything, apparently. And there's always a different miracle brain surgery that's one of a kind that they do every week.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous, but it's TV, isn't it?
I think my experience is probably more like Scrubs.
Fair.
But yeah, so I just stumbled into psychiatry just by accident, really. I found an affinity with talking to people who are mentally ill, who are quite psychotic. And then it was only after I started my formal psychiatric training that I stumbled into forensics. So I worked on a ward with people that had committed quite serious offences. And that was the first time that it tied into my morbid intrigue about violence and crime. So I didn't even know that it existed as a subspecialty until I actually did a placement in it.
Do you remember the first like major case that you were brought into? What was, of course you can't talk about the details, but yeah. What was that like for you?
Absolutely I do, yeah. So I don't think it's the first ever patient I saw, but it's the first time I gave evidence in court, and it was at the Old Bailey. And it was for a young teenage girl who had become floridly psychotic literally overnight with very little warning. She was never antisocial, never violent before, never had problems with a mental illness before. And she suffocated and killed her nephew just out of the blue when she was babysitting him. And it was really kind of emotionally charged for me, as it would be for most people. I assessed her in prison. It was a really difficult assessment because she was very uncooperative. So because she was so psychotic, we found out later, months down the line, that she had this intense kind of paranoia, and she thought that people, including myself, were out to try and kill her. And so I just couldn't get anything from assessing her. And I felt really nervous because I was very aware that the evidence that I give would potentially really change the outcome of either her staying in prison for most of her life or going to a psychiatric hospital for a few years. And just the experience of going to the Old Bailey and standing there really nervous in a suit and being cross-examined by a judge and a barrister. It's fine now because I've done it many times since then, but the very first time I definitely remember. And the other element was her brother, who's the father of the victim. I would liaise with him quite frequently to get like some history about the patient herself, and also just in terms of family therapy. And that was obviously quite emotionally charged as well, because on the one hand he's looking out for his sister, but on the other hand he's, you know, the father of the victim. So yeah, very
extremely difficult,
convoluted, yeah, emotional situation.
Yeah,
absolutely. Do you find yourself getting emotionally invested in the cases that you investigate?
I think I've developed a way of kind of separating work from my own personal life. Of course, there's cases where it's extremely difficult and it takes a lot longer to research and write the scripts about and film and edit because they're just so horrendous. And there's a lot of details that we don't end up putting in the video because they're just too gruesome and intense. And especially when I'm working with family members, that can be really, really difficult to interview them and talk to them about their experiences. And yeah, it can be really hard sometimes, but I think we work as a 9 to 5. I'm in the office now. We come into work at 9, finish at six, and then we have our own time off. But I think I've got a good way of trying to separate that from directly affecting me mostly. I mean, you kind of have to, otherwise I wouldn't be able to do what I do.
And do you work full time on your channel?
Yes. So the company I own, we have a few employees and we work with another company. We manage my channel and a few other projects that we have and a merchandising company all at once. But I do predominantly my channel, the research, filming, editing. I do all of it myself, bar research, which either my brand and production manager helps with the research, or we've had a few other people that have worked with us with researching so that we can get certain things out. Because I get a lot of emails from people who really want their pet case, so like a John Doe case or a case that's really local to them, that's very difficult for us to get information about. So they end up doing research and then send us what they found and all their research, and then I turn that into a script, and then we pay them obviously for their time because it's very difficult. And then I do everything myself. We did have an editor at one point, but I am just a bit of a control freak with the final video and I went way too long.
I have to ask you this, right? So there are a lot of people that attempt or have attempted to do what you do, which is to work full-time and make a living from your channel, but I imagine very few actually get that level of popularity. So have you done it? Have you got, like, so I know you've got 160,000 followers almost on YouTube. How do you do that?
Yeah, we the difficulty of being on YouTube is, I mean, even when you're uploading just your podcast to YouTube, is YouTube would always put the advertisers first. So I don't think you are in the partner program quite yet, but when you do get in the partner program, you'll realize just how many rules there are. And I think I spent a good 3 or 4 months reverse engineering their process to find our own way of ensuring that content is monetized. Because it sounds like, oh, we just make it for money. But if a video isn't monetized, then YouTube doesn't push it because they take a large cut of the ad revenue. And if they don't monetize it, then there's no incentive for them to push it to audiences. And there's a lot of proof that this happens. So the last thing we want is a case that because we cover lesser known cases, we don't want that to not get the attention that it deserves using our platform. So we have to ensure that it's monetized for that reason. And also because we have to pay the employees, the house that I'm currently in, you know, all the bills that come with it. And I kind of fell into it. I was never intended to be a job. It just kind of happened. And I quit my job in July of 2019.
It's fair to want to get paid for your videos because, as you said, this is your job. It's not like, you know, this is your source of income. It's not something you're doing just...
Yeah, it's not just my income. It's the people that work for me is income, because we hired in the middle at the start of lockdown one. So it was really fortunate that we're able to do that and give people some security with their income. But we also do sponsorships a lot because YouTube is difficult and they just don't like true crime often. They just don't like it being covered. But if a news channel like BBC News or whatever decides to cover in vivid detail a case, they're perfectly fine to have ads. I have beef with YouTube.
My approach to videos is very different from yours, simply because I don't have the time. So I have probably got a maximum of 1 or 2 hours realistically to research any video that I make, and about the same to record it. And yeah, because I don't have the time, I know that I'm not going to compete with just factual information. So my USP, I think, is being able to talk about the psychiatric aspects and to give a professional opinion, and try and compare the true crime case especially the perpetrator, with patients that I've seen.
It's really interesting, your content, with those comparisons and with that expert knowledge, to see when, you know, when you are being called to be an expert witness in court, to see how that kind of plays out and your side of the story. Because I mean, there's a lot on YouTube, there's a lot of people who've got their psychology degree and then they use that, but then getting that next tier, like that next level of information, and the way that you explain it too is really, really, really helpful. And
thank you.
Doesn't make me feel like I'm sat in like a lecture or something.
Thank you. I have to say, I'm struggling to kind of get out there. I think that making good content is only the first step. You have to actually kind of break through the competition.
And unfortunately now, everything's so saturated with, regardless of podcast, YouTube, everywhere, even TikTok now, it's just so difficult to get that initial traction. And I knew this was the same when I started. So I don't know how I did it. I did something called Summer of True Crime, where I collaborated with 25 different creators in the true crime world, regardless of size, regardless of anything, just to come together for this common, you know, this common goal. And we did a ridiculous amount of videos, and I don't think I slept very much for like the 2-3 months it was on. But that really helped is diversifying the audience. And I think that applies with podcasts too, because you can definitely, you know, be a guest speaker on different podcasts, and it can really help. I think collaborating is one of the oldest and best ways, I think, of growing a channel, as long as it's done in the right way.
Is there any point in your journey where you just thought, you consider giving up, or you just thought this isn't worth the effort?
All the time. All the time. First, hate comments are horrendous. I think with podcasts it's easy because you don't really see hate comments. You can't comment on a Spotify, you can't comment on Apple Podcasts, but on YouTube people hide behind their keyboards and they come for whatever, absolutely anything, and it is not nice at all. To begin with, it can be really, really difficult to deal with, because there's all these people that don't know you saying all these things about you. From I suffer with acne, so from acne to the way I speak, people question my sexuality under my videos, even though it's got nothing to do with what I'm talking about. And there's been lots of times, I think, with the hate comments. I think, but though, over time it gets easier. I mean, I don't really look at the comments at the moment, which sounds bad, but I think it gets to a point where you're getting 400-500 to 1,000 comments on a video. You can't really read them all. So I only really read the top 5 to 10 comments, because usually that's the general consensus of how an audience is taking the video. But yeah, there's been lots of moments. I mean, there was one where a family member contacted me and asked me to take down the video, and I felt so bad. I felt so guilty. I felt like I'd offended them, I'd done so wrong. It wasn't like that at all, though. They were very like, we'd just rather not have a video up. We'd rather just be in peace. But there's also a lot of lessons that you learn from that. Like, I try to reach out to family for every case that I cover now, to get permission and stuff like that. But you know what? We stick through it, and I don't know what I'd do now if I wasn't doing this. So yeah, it's that's really the only downsides. Well, I mean, there was this one major one that was earlier this year, which really made me just want to go, I'm deleting the channel, I'm over this, I don't want this anymore. And it's when my cousin, she was in South Africa, and she had to go into facility for an eating disorder. So I put up on my channel, I just put up the link to the GoFundMe, just explaining it's my cousin and she needs some help. And I think people have this idea that YouTubers are so rich. I mean, I'm not that rich. I have no money in my bank account right now. But they have this idea that you're a millionaire or something ridiculous like that. And I got lots of really, really nasty comments. And then my cousin committed suicide. And
because of the
I
comments,
think that,
or was that...
Not because of the comments. It was unrelated. She hadn't seen them. But I think just that event, and then the comments still coming in saying that I'm selfish, that I'm a horrible person for just trying to raise money for my cousin.
Yeah. Well, that's horrible.
That was definitely.
Sorry you had to go through all that. I knew of these kind of things happen, but I didn't know that it would happen to that extent.
Your entire life is on show. You've got to be really selective of what you share.
So in terms of the specific cases you've done, are there any... I know you mentioned Madeleine McCann, but you said you never make a video on that. Are there any ones that you have made videos on that stick out for you as being different in the way that they feel compared to the other ones?
The Mark Zatruz series, it was a I think it was three parts in total in the end. I think I did it in summer of 2019. It was a series about this Belgian serial child molester and killer. It started off as just a one video, thinking it was just, you know, this kind of straightforward case. But then it kind of, as I researched more and more and found out more and more and more, it turned out to be quite a massive conspiracy within Belgium of this child trafficking network. That case alone sticks out a lot because it was getting to the point I had to cut the series short and kind of wrap it up, because I was just getting, it was involving active members of Belgian government. There were accusations and I just did not want to get involved. I got a bit paranoid about it, so I had to stop that series. But that one always really stands out to me because of how they just let this guy go.
And were you the first person or one of the only people to uncover it?
Yes. Well, to talk about it, I can't quite remember the research. It was a 2-3, maybe even a month long research into that whole series. But I'm very, very good at finding things out. So I found all the case files, had them translated, and then all these different testimonies, newspaper archives, everything that was mentioned about the case, rumors, everything like that, kind of bringing it all together. It was very difficult.
Wow.
Especially because of the nature of it, because it's about children. Those are always difficult.
Yeah, absolutely.
Always.
So I was just thinking about the kind of cases that I've seen that have impacted me the most. And I think it kind of reflects the case that I see in real life in my NHS work, in that the ones that strike, that emotionally impact me, are not necessarily the most gruesome or the most violent. It's actually because I feel sorry for the perpetrator, usually because they've got a mental illness. So I actually gave, like, separate to my YouTube channel, I gave evidence in a case in the Old Bailey about a psychotic mother who killed her own child, which is not too dissimilar to that very first case I told you. And then I made a video on Andrea Yates, who killed her own children, five children, in 2001. And yeah, I don't know how to put this into words. Like, sometimes I feel, if mental illness is involved, then I feel quite sympathetic for the perpetrator and how much their life is ruined, just as much as I do the victims. It's different if it's not a mental illness. If somebody's doing something, you know, horrific on purpose, that's different. But those are the ones that really sort of send shivers down my spine a little bit.
Yeah, there was this, I've done a case, and I can't remember the title off the top of my head, but it was a very long video, and it was this teenager, well, college age student, and he had a psychotic break, I guess you could call it, and ends up murdering two people, complete strangers. But all the times where he could have been received care or received attention that were just ignored, it did really upset me when I was doing that, because it was just this lack of, from his own family and from his friends, and he thought he was Jesus at one point. Like, it's just classic signs of delusions of grandeur that should, the major indicators. He was saying that he was seeing things that weren't there. He thought he became super religious. I think he was diagnosed in the end with bipolar, but I don't think it was bipolar. I've had first-hand experience with bipolar disorder, so I don't believe that. But, you know, I don't know the cases ins and outs completely, but it's things like that where there is this mental health, these disorders that are involved. And it also makes it a lot more difficult when you're covering it, because the general public and their perceptions of certain disorders like bipolar disorder, which already gets such a massive bad rep as it is. And it can be really sad to see people commenting saying that they have bipolar disorder and, you know, this is not something that it could be blamed for or anything like that. And it's true. It's just, a disorder doesn't mean that you're going to do these things. There's plenty of people, I'm sure you know, that live with schizophrenia and are perfectly functioning.
Yeah.
It's really sad to see those views still in the public.
So what you're talking about is exactly like the central focus of my channel. But I think it helps to talk about these cases and to try and get the listeners and the viewers to have a perspective of the perpetrator and of the perpetrator's sort of family, and just kind of understand that it's tragic for everybody, and that in some cases, not all cases, not everybody who's mentally ill, who commits a crime, is criminally responsible. But on the other hand, some of them are as well. That's why there's sort of very specific systems and assessments to figure it out. So what attracts you to cases? What does a case need to have for you to consider it?
We have a dedicated website now called requestacase.com, where viewers send in cases, and it's thousands and thousands of entries long. And we first port of call is to go through those submissions, and we check to see the coverage, we check to see whether we can find reliable sources, information about it, because unfortunately on YouTube, I think especially for my channel, it seems that any video less than 30 minutes doesn't like to perform very well. I'm not really sure why, something to do with the algorithm, who knows. So we try to make sure that there's enough behind the case to be able to cover it. We just try to focus on lesser known. It's weird because we just have this gut feeling when we come across a case. Sometimes a case suggestion can lead to another case that can lead to another case, and you just kind of have this gut feeling that this is a good case to cover. But there's some times where it gets scripts done, you know, research is all completed, but then it's like, this case, we're just going to shelve it because something's not right.
So even though you put in all the work, you shelve it?
Yeah, we don't want to cover cases or create videos that don't have accurate information in, that we can't verify. And we had that with I just did a video about Peggy Ann Bradnick, who was kidnapped for 8 days. And there was a series of books that were written about her. And she survived, by the way, and she's doing really well. But there's a series of books and articles written about her that had all this information that didn't match up with one another. And then she published her own book, thankfully, because that was really helpful. You know, it was her own accounts of it, which were really, really helpful. But trying to check against different sources of what is correct and what is rumor, false, because newspapers aren't very accurate, let's be real. But they're a good place to start, I think.
Do you think it's a problem in the true crime podcasting world of misinformation, of people not doing research properly?
Definitely. There's no... we always source. We always cite our sources in every video we do, constantly. Unfortunately, a lot of people take what podcasters or YouTubers say about something as factual, even when it may not be. So when we are referring to a piece of information, sometimes we'll go as far as say, according to this source, yada, 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 if we couldn't verify it, because we don't want to be spreading misinformation about a case. And especially if it is an active case or it's a cold case, that can be extremely damaging to the investigation as it is. I went to a really interesting talk. Sky Crime invited me a few years ago to London for the launch of the Sky Crime channel. And they had a really interesting talk about misinformation online and how that can affect an investigation from a police officer. And I think that was really, really beneficial to take on board for myself as well, to make sure that we are not spreading false information.
You know, it's funny you say that, because when I first started my channel a few months ago or 6 months ago, I obviously researched the competition, and I was quite surprised about the number of people that present themselves as professionals and don't actually really know what they're talking about. And in fact, I even made a kind of beef diss video against this other doctor who's a doctor of a PhD in philosophy. And he calls himself Dr. Whatever. If you're interested, you can see it on my channel. But he talks about psychiatric and psychological issues. And I think he's kind of heavily insinuating that he's an expert, but he's not. And yeah. I just think that there's something a bit cynical about doing that. And I think that anybody can make a video. That's absolutely anybody's right. But like you do, I think you should state your sources or state your expertise. You know, if it's factual, state your sources. If it's your expertise, then state your experience.
Never pretend to be in the know.
Exactly, yeah.
Unless I've spoken directly with people involved in investigation, which we have full disclosure on the channel. We disclose everything that we do, because at the end of the day, I'm not an expert in anything that I do. I'm just good at making videos. That's all I'm good.
But you'll be surprised about of the number of people that don't do that, that kind of place themselves in a position where they come across as experts.
I know, and it's dangerous. It's very dangerous, especially if they're spreading common myth about something, or this perception of a mental health issue, or just bad information about how something operates or a case. It can be dangerous.
Yeah,
and I suppose we always try to change names as well. We change a lot of names when we're doing our scripts, from their actual names to fake names, especially brothers, sisters of victims. Because we've had before where a bunch of audience members have gone and found these people because they've said their names and tried to speak to them. And it's horrific, and we don't want that to happen at all, regardless of whether it's clear that they're involved or they've gotten away with something. It's not my place to do that.
So have you don't have to name any names, but have you ever come across any content producers who you think intentionally jazz things up or mislead? And I don't mean by mistake, I mean intentionally do it to try and gain popularity or clout.
I've seen some, but I don't think they were long-lived. I think there's definitely I think an audience can definitely see authenticity, whether it is on podcast or it is on YouTube. I think there's definitely, I think because there's so many really successful, really good and talented creators and podcasters, I think an audience who is listened and watched or to all those different things definitely can see through the bullshit. But then my own friends, I tried to keep my friends. I only really make friends on YouTube that are, you know, in it for the right reasons. But there are some people that are popular that I don't agree with how they do what they do. And I don't agree that they don't source their information and kind of humorize it a lot, if that makes sense. I'm not going to throw any shade at anyone, but it's just from my own personal experience and standpoint. And I just don't think that's morally right to do stuff like that for the value of entertainment.
And I suppose the problem is that it can't really be policed because anybody can put anything up, really, can't they?
No, I know of some creators who have been contacted by family to take down videos who just ignore them. And I think that's disgusting. I always try to put myself in the shoes of the people I'm covering with everything that I create. And of course, there's times where I mess up. Everyone messes up when in their coverage. Even professionals doing documentaries mess up with their coverage. And it's just learning from that and taking the right steps forward. And this again does apply to podcasts too, because anyone can make a podcast, anyone can make a YouTube video. It is one of the beauties of it is that it's accessible to absolutely everybody, but it does come with those risks and dangers, I think.
Yeah.
What else did you find out on your deep dive of the competition?
I think there's a big sort of disparity about how good they are. So some people make excellent content and are really entertaining. Some people make content that is actually very, very basic, and you can tell that they don't really have much of an in-depth kind of background or experience, and what they've got is probably from like a textbook or a Wikipedia page, but they can shroud it in enough words to make it look...
Wikipedia readers. I know one too many podcasts and one too many YouTubers who just read a case from Wikipedia, just change up how it's plagiarism. There was a scandal, I think it was last year, with a creator, I'm friends with her, Shauna Ray, and she was accused of plagiarizing, and she had to run her scripts through one of the plagiarizing software. She had to pay for it to prove that she wasn't plagiarizing. I mean, there had been instances where she had actually made some mistakes and stolen another one of my friend's scripts from his podcast and put it on YouTube, but the internet attacked her. She ended up deleting the channel, and it was really sad to see, but there is, I don't know where I'm going with my point. ADHD, what can I say? I forgot what we're talking about. What were we talking about?
You asked me what I learned about the competition.
Sorry, we got to Wikipedia readers and then I went off.
I think that's a trigger point for you, right?
Did you research my channel?
Yeah. Of course I watched
three
of your videos. Yeah.
What did you find? Some content I'm not happy with. The thing is, because I end up editing at like 3 o'clock in the morning, and I get really tired by the end of a video. So the first half of a video is amazing in terms of editing. Then the second half is a bit, it's something I'm trying to work on, but it's always difficult.
The one thing that struck me about your videos compared to mine was just the level of detail. So I don't have the time or the inclination to do as much research as you do. And so I'm not going to say I use Wikipedia, but I don't go into a lot of detail either.
We're fortunate to have access to a lot of different databases within the justice system as well, and different archives for a whole host of different things, which really help putting a case together. And of course, reaching out to family, you know, first party accounts is always impactful within a video.
And then the resource that you use, are they available to everybody, or did you have to like source them yourself or pay for them separately?
Some of them are only available to professionals, which we managed to get access to because my company the other day is a motion picture production company, and it has been that for before I did YouTube. So I was able to use contacts to get into certain different things, but the majority of it is available just online. I mean, it's just knowing where to look and how to decipher it all. And I'm really good at finding things. Katie was researching a case a while ago. She was coming to a finish, almost finished on the research. And then I ended up finding a 300 page document that was the full case files. I printed it out and popped it on her desk, and she was like, oh, for goodness sake. Because now she had to read through all of that and make sure everything was right. And I don't think it was even in English. I think it was Bulgarian or Romanian, sorry. It's a gift and a curse sometimes, because you want to add as much information as possible, but also you've got to know when to not add certain pieces of information. So how much time do you say you spend an hour to 2 hours on research itself? How much time do you then put into filming and editing?
I get my videos professionally edited through somebody that I just found off. It wasn't Fiverr, but it's like one of those websites. I've been working with her for a while because I'm completely technologically retarded. I wouldn't even know how to edit in if I had the software. And in terms of the actual recording, I'm getting a little bit slicker at it and a bit quicker, but it just takes me ages just to set up the equipment. I'm just a bit older than you, and I'm not used to like social media. I'm not used to using all these types of equipment. But my videos aren't anywhere near as detailed as yours. But again, I think I'm not trying to make it them factual. The facts that I find out are only to put the cases into context. I'm really talking about when I'm picking a case, I only pick cases where I think I've got something to say, or I've had an experience. So for example, I'm in the middle of writing a series on Broadmoor patients because I worked at Broadmoor when I was a middle grade psychiatrist. So I'm trying to choose people that the public would have heard of or that they might not have heard of, but are very interesting or unusual cases because I can speak from some kind of experience and expertise. So my research is nowhere near as detailed as you. I've certainly not ever had a Bulgarian or Romanian document, especially of that kind of length.
The Mark the True series was all in Belgian. Well, is that the language I have? It was in a different language. French. Yeah. There you go. Oh yeah, because Hercule Poirot. No, that was difficult as well. I had to get someone who is French to help translate a lot of it. But it's also really difficult to get that kind of accurate translation because of the topic, because it is very heavy to try and get those in. But we do try and do quite a wide range of different countries, because a lot of YouTubers tend to focus on, and podcasts tend to focus on, American or UK, and we do like to try and branch out sometimes where we can into Romania or Belgium. We've done a lot of Dutch cases, South Africa, so it's all over the place.
Do you think there's one country that kind of piques your interest more than the others?
I want to do, I think just because of my family, I think I want to do a lot more South African cases. And a really amazing YouTuber, Mufundu Nadala, she's South African and she does cover quite a lot of South African cases. And I really want to work with her to cover more of the cases over there because it is a hellhole, unfortunately. You asked me at the beginning, what made you decide to do YouTube?
I think it was a combination of things. So I think that with my line of work, people are more interested in it than I am. So when I meet new people, dinner parties, whatever, they tend to have loads of questions for me. And because I do it day in, day out, it's kind of, I've become inured to it. So I always knew that there was like a thirst for knowing about mental illness and how it relates to violence especially. And then when I started looking around at competition, I realized that, as I say before, there's a lot of misinformation. So I thought that's not accurate or it's not detailed enough. So I can make better content than this. And also I've done little bits of media work here and there. So I've been like on Radio 4, been on TV a couple of times. And when I go on these programs or shows, the questions that they ask me aren't quite my area of expertise. So to be specific, they always want to know about like terrorists or serial killers. And I can speak about those sort of topics, but then I've only like assessed maybe two or three in my entire career. What I'm more experienced about is talking about individual diagnoses of mental illness. So, you know, schizophrenia, bipolar, you're talking about before, and specifically how those symptoms lead to offending. So because I wasn't quite getting asked the right questions and I was only being asked about stuff that I knew a little bit about, but wasn't my expertise, I thought, right, I'm either going to continue doing this or I make my own content. I can't expect other people to know what to ask me.
I think it's such an amazing viewpoint to have. I think it's really, really interesting. And I think it will, for you, pick up quite significantly, because I've never seen anyone doing that and talking about it like that. So I think it's really kind of a gold mine when it comes to viewership and your audience. I think it will grow. Once you have that one video that kicks off, I think it's going to grow quite substantially from there, because it is really interesting. And I think the way that you focus on people who you'd consider everyday people that then just kind of snap, even though it's not like that, but it's just that idea I think a lot of people have makes them very uncomfortable, because it could be anyone that they know. But then also the way that you educate people about these different illnesses and disorders at the same time is really, really beneficial, I think, because there's so much taboo. I think there's a mass acceptance of mental illness if it's depression and anxiety. If it's anything more than that, it seems like people are scared of it. They hate it completely.
I completely agree. I think part of the problem, slightly ironically, is that in the last maybe 10 years, a lot of celebrities have come out with their experiences of mental illness. And I do think that's a good thing, definitely. But it tends to be the kind of very common disorders like depression or anxiety. And they tend to be quite mild. Again, I think it's a good thing they come out. But the problem is it kind of marginalizes the people with different types of disorders, the rarer ones or the more severe ones. So you've got your celebrity that's talking about anxiety and depression. You don't really have any celebrities that talk about ADHD or talk about schizophrenia. So yeah, it kind of glamorizes almost some experiences of mental illness.
I also think one of the major issues is the tabloid's attitude to celebrities that have mental illness. Let's take a look at, you know, Britney Spears, for example. We all know and remember that picture of her bald and the way that that was turned into a joke. And even with substance abuse, the way that attitudes towards substance abusers, it's disgusting in itself, because it's not, I see it more of as a disease, as an illness, than it is a, you know, oh, I just woke up one day and decided to be addicted to cocaine. You know, it's just not how it is. I don't think anyone wakes up and is like, you know what, today I'm gonna do heroin. It's not how it goes.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think the tabloids, I think it's getting better very, very slowly. So I've worked, I first qualified as a doctor in 2003. And within that time, I've definitely seen the attitudes very slowly shift. Not because I think people are necessarily sort of better educated, or some people. I think it's because there is more of a woke culture. So people will call you out on it, whereas they wouldn't have done before. And also the rise of, you know, social media and Twitter means that people can put their two cents in. So I do think it's heading
right. Yeah, share their experiences.
But it's still... still a long, long way to go. Absolutely, I agree with you. I think the stigma of mental illness is a huge kind of problem.
It applies within true crime. It applies to jury bias a lot. And it's really sad to see, because you have these preconceptions of these things. And like somebody with, say, bipolar, if they commit a crime and it's found that, you know, it was, they were not responsible due to XYZ, a jury, because of this bias that they will already have from the media, I'm talking mostly about in America here, they will be, oh, they are insane, put them away forever so they can never harm again. But that's not how mental illness works. It's not like it's on 24/7, you know, with most disorders, right? It's a lot that generally quite episodic. I mean, bipolar in itself is a series of different episodes, not, and it's not like, I mean, there is fast switching, if I remember right, but it more commonly it is just maybe a few weeks to a few months. You can correct me on this, this is your expertise, you know, the manic and then the depressive episodes and in-betweens. Like
what you're saying is absolutely correct. It's so you have periods of mania where your mood's elevated, euthymia when you're in the middle, and depression, and usually it's weeks. You can get rapid cycling, which is when it's days or even sometimes hours. I think there's a misconception that people who go, especially they've committed serious crimes, get an easy option by going to forensic psychiatric hospitals, which is actually not the case. So especially when the crime's quite unpalatable, like when it's murder, like a few cases that I've seen, murdering a child, I think there's the public begs for blood and they want to see the perpetrator suffer. And they assume that going to a hospital is a lot easier than going to a prison. And I mean, the purpose of a hospital obviously is to rehabilitate and to treat, and it's not for punishment, but it's not an easier ride, I'd say. I mean, you're still locked up. You still have a routine that you have to follow. There's just a lot more rehabilitation and therapy focused. And
right. Is this idea that a prison should be a complete punishment end and end and not a rehabilitation system? I think for the majority of offences, they should work to be rehabilitated. And that just comes into prison reform, which is a whole different story. I mean, there's certain things which are very controversial when it comes to different crimes, such as crimes against children, where it's very controversial whether those people can be rehabilitated. But then, correct me if I'm wrong, I remember reading about paedophilia being a mental illness more than it is just this crime that people want to commit.
It's really complicated. So it kind of depends. It depends on the individual cases. So paraphilia is like a psychiatric diagnosis, but that in itself is quite controversial. I think there are some people who suffer from like obsessional or intrusive sexual images who try their best to resist them, and they are less risky, and they're certainly people that can be treated. Sometimes they haven't even committed any offences. They just approach services wanting treatment. that's one end of the spectrum. Then on the other end of the spectrum, you get people who are a lot more predatory, who will, you know, commit crimes without much resistance and try and hide them. So they're a lot more dangerous and arguably much harder to treat. And there's everyone in.
Yeah, it's not black and white at all. No, I don't think any mental illness or disorder, it's not black and white. And that is another thing that it seems to be this general public conception is that it is black and white. You can be diagnosed with depression. It doesn't mean you're going to have depression your entire life. And some, it depends on whether it's chemical or, you know, all these different causes. It's not as easy as a lot of people, I think, seem. And I'm not sure whether it is to do with education. I'm not sure whether there should be more education on mental illness and more than just depression, anxiety within schools as part of personal development or whatever segment there is within the curriculum.
I think you're absolutely right. I think people don't know, the general public doesn't really know about it. I mean, so think about the number of true crime documentaries that there are. I mean, there's literally dozens, if not hundreds of them. And then think about the number of actual documentaries there are inside psychiatric units. I mean, I think, to my knowledge, I've only ever seen two, one inside Broadmoor, one by Stacey Dooley. It's just not something.
Oh, we do love Stacey Dooley.
Yeah. They're just not something that people know about, which is strange to me, because I think people are genuinely interested. I mean, maybe not everybody, but
it kind of doesn't sell as well because it sounds like you have to be educated to watch it, if that makes sense, which is a shame. And I think what you're doing is, because it's so accessible and it's not like dedicated, this is just for, doesn't give the impression that it's just for, you know, people who are within your field, and it is accessible to everyone. I think that is really what is beneficial there, is because it is that education within it. I think that's one of the approaches that they need to have with the documentaries about that, is that it can't be framed in a way of, from that medical side, it has to combine the different elements together to be able to be accessible and to be attractive to viewers, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
But no one's found that combination yet.
It can't be stuffy, basically, if it's stuffy and boring. And
you've got to reward viewers, as it applies with podcasts too. You've got to reward viewers when you dump a bunch of facts on them, you know, because if it's just facts, I'm going to fall asleep. Like, it's going to be like you're just reading wikipedia.org. like, it's not going to be interesting. And it's finding that balance as well, I think, is really important.
So what do you do to break up the factual nature of what you're talking about in your videos?
We use a lot of on-screen graphics and overlays, which really help, because if something interesting on screen when they're watching it and I'm saying something that's fairly boring, they're still going to be interested because there's something interesting happening on the screen. For example, the mapping that we do with the mapping graphics and any animated graphics. I can't remember what case I did, but I think it was South African, you know. And it was, we animated a map of the movements through the house and where different elements were found. During that, there had to be a lot of kind of boring factual information about the evidence and things that people aren't that interested in, but we wanted to make sure that they were still engaged by watching that. And it's a lot more difficult, I think, with podcasts, because you don't have that fallback on video and visuals, but you do have a lot of the time. I mean, usually it's just one of us, right? There's only one of us talking. Usually there's one solid narrator on YouTube, but within podcasts, you do have the multiple people usually, which always helps as the fallback to generate that interest and keep engagement. But keeping people engaged is difficult. There's no master formula to it at all. I mean, if I tell you anything else, that's business secrets. So I'll save that for another day. Sorry, CrimeCon, you can't have that.
What tips would you give to anybody who wants to start their own true crime podcast?
Consistency, upload, just do it, just start, just go. Make sure your research is good and source it. I use a free website called mybib.com. It's a free Chrome extension. You just click on it and it will add it to your list on MyBib, and it can tell you using AI whether it thinks, and using user reports, whether it thinks it's credible or not, which is a really good stepping stone, like to see whether this particular newspaper, if you're doing a case from a different country, you don't know whether, you know, the Yealink Telegraph is an accurate news source because it's a local one to wherever that is. So using things like tools like that really help find credibility there, and then cross-referencing. It's a pain, but it has to be done. And then also read your script, read it, don't just write it, read through it at the end, review it, make sure you know what's going on. There's so many times where I forget to read it and it gets onto the teleprompter and I'm changing it mid while I'm filming it. I'm changing it the script, which is a pain for Katie because she does all the captionings for the videos. So she takes the script and tries to put it into the captioning, and then she spends ages correcting what I've changed, which is annoying for her. But that's another thing within content, is making sure it's accessible to everybody. So we do ensure there are subtitle closed captions on the videos, or subtitling hard burned in if it's an accent that's regional that someone might not understand. But tips are really keep it in a story structure. Don't have it as in like, don't make it look like you're reading it off Wikipedia. Make it a story. You've got your beginning, middle, end. It's fairly straightforward with a case. You've got your beginning about them or what happens, your teaser, your middle about the person leading up to the crime, and then the end, the investigation, conclusion, that kind of thing. A fairly simple structure. And it is quite straightforward with true crime because it does tend to happen chronologically. So that keeps it interesting. If you're doing YouTube, make sure there's visuals. If you're doing it on podcast, try and have music in the background to kind of not make it seem monotonous. And don't have a monotonous voice. I had a monotonous voice to begin with. Trying to find ways to just like make your voice go up and down a bit more, you know, not as no. Make it up and down, you know, express emotions. And don't give your opinion unless it is, you know, you're an expert in that thing. Don't add things that aren't there, because giving your opinion when you're not educated on a topic is dangerous in regards to anything. If you're a TV presenter, anything, giving your opinion on anything, if you're not educated in that, is dangerous. Yeah. When you're in a position of having an audience that you can influence.
Just to expand on that, I've certainly seen or heard other podcasts, true crime podcasts, where they have a guest on and either the host or the guest just makes big assumptions. So, you know, how is this person feeling? Do you think this happened because of this and this? And
yeah, don't do that.
Yeah. I think it's okay to do that if you have the information, but I suppose it's technically not an assumption then. But I think it's okay to say there's, you know, if you've got a lot of information, then I think this suggests this, as long as you use the word suggests.
But, right, you know, I do that a lot. I also use indicative a lot. It could be indicative of this, this, and this.
So in terms of my tips, I mean, I'm not anywhere near as experienced as you are, Joshua, but from my limited months, I would also say that because the space is so saturated, new podcasters might need to think about a different angle that's just slightly different. So,
right, we don't want two people sat in a room talking about a case. So it's been done about 1,000
exactly.
times now.
Yeah.
So finding a different approach, a different angle, I agree, is 100% a great way to go about it. And I know it sounds bad, right? But try to avoid the big cases, because there's so much coverage already and there's not much that you can add to it. Lesser cases deserve an equal amount of attention, lesser known cases. So try and find those. And if a family member asks you to take it down, take it down. Put your ego away, take it down. Put yourself in their shoes.
Thanks for listening to this special episode. We'll be at CrimeCon in London on September 25th and 26th. If you'd like to come, tickets are on sale now. Go to crimecon.co.uk and use the ticket code Joshua to get 10% off.